From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Top news tonight, the Bush administration has awarded a contract for as much as $680 million to the Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco to rebuild power, water, and sewage systems in Iraq. And this is only the biggest, so far, of many reconstruction contracts flowing to well-wired American firms. The need in Iraq is clearly great and urgent, but some in Congress and beyond are asking if the fast handoff of huge contracts amounts to crony capitalism. Tonight on Point, reconstruction as spoils of war or the fastest track to a functioning Iraq. You can join us. Is the well-wired War Incorporated going in for the big post-war bucks, spoils for friends of the Bush White House, or is it just what it takes here to get clean water, roads, schools, and hospitals to Iraq ASAP? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Joshua Chaffin, Washington business correspondent for the Financial Times. Good evening and welcome, Joshua Chaffin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And joining us from New York is Leighton McCartney, freelance journalist and author of Friends in High Places, The Bechtel Story, The Most Secret Corporation, and How It Engineered the World. Good evening and welcome, Leighton McCartney.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Leighton McCartney, let me turn to you first. The news just in about an hour ago that Bechtel has landed this contract, starts out at around $30 million, but could grow to $680 million. First stage, we read, for power, water, and sewage systems in Iraq. Bechtel is not exactly a secret. It's well known for big projects around the country and around the world. But is it any surprise that it lands this contract? Is this just business? Is this just open competition in the way things ought to be?
I think the surprise would be if they didn't land the contract. It's one of the few companies that has the capacity to do a major job like this, and it's also well-wired, as we all know, to the White House, so those two factors certainly gave it a strong edge.
What does that wiring look like, those connections to the White House that you referred to?
Well, a lot of companies have political influence. I think the difference between Bechtel and a lot of other companies is theirs go way back. I mean, Bechtel was negotiating to build pipelines in Iraq in the early 50s. During the Reagan years, they had all kinds of people in place, including George Shultz, who was Secretary of State, who was negotiating, trying to get a pipeline built between Iraq and Jordan. Mm-hmm. Philip Habib, I don't know if you remember him, but he was Mideast envoy. He was, at the same time he was doing that, he was working for Bechtel. So the connections with Bechtel are deeper and they're broader, because these kind of deals is not just enough to be tied into one particular branch of the government. To put these things together, you need the financing capabilities, you need the State Department to smooth the way, you need whoever else is can be helpful. These are enormous projects, and it takes a lot of connections and a lot of deep connections so you can facilitate the contracts quickly.
Joshua Chaffin, you, like the rest of us, have seen the sound and fury about this first sort of $1.7 billion tranche of redevelopment and how the contracts are going out. What's your perspective here? Is it how many companies are there in the world that could have done this? Is it a surprise that Bechtel's got the job, or would the surprise be, as Leighton McCartney says, if they didn't get it? Does this smell right or not?
Well, I think Leighton makes a very good point that it is one of the few companies that's really uniquely qualified to do the work. But I think also there's so much political sensitivity around the rebuilding, which is basically following on from the same political sensitivity and controversy leading up to the war itself. And so I think that's opened up, led to even more scrutiny and even more suspicion. And I think the closed bidding process that USAID used for this contract, they have an argument that they've made that it was done for reasons of speed and national security. And their arguments all seem very legitimate, but at the same time, if you're suspicious of the war in the first place, as many people in Europe are in particular, then those arguments don't hold much weight.
Joshua Chaffin, walk us back through the brief history of these contracts. As I understand it, it was already in January that the U.S. government was putting out a 12, 13-page paper describing what reconstruction requirements would be after the war and beginning to line up contractors to do that. Is that correct?
That's right. And they asked only a handful of companies, well-connected large companies. In addition to Bechtel, there's also Halliburton, Fluor, etc. Halliburton in particular, Vice President Cheney ran the company from 1995 to 2000. So that one sort of jumps out. One of the considerations that USAID pointed to was the fact that these companies had security clearances, and that this was important because the tender for the contracts had gone out before the war had actually begun. Now, a lot of critics, even in the U.S. Congress, have said it wasn't much of a surprise to anyone in the world that even in January the U.S. was considering or preparing a possible invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. So the arguments that they've made aren't exactly airtight, and I think given the political sensitivity, it sort of opened them up to even more criticism than I think they expected going into this.
You're saying the arguments that the Bush administration has made are not airtight. In what sense?
Right, and that's the Agency for International Development in particular. Well, I think the security clearance argument is one that legalistically it may be accurate, but I don't think anybody, or many people certainly, I don't think they, I don't know that they buy the fact that it was necessary to keep these contracts secret as recently as January. I think just about everybody knew that the administration was considering this invasion, and given that that fact that this work would follow. There are other points that they've made that I think are that hold up much better. One of those is the federal procurement procedures, and these call for the government to give preference to U.S. companies if the contracts are being funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars, and that's sort of been the policy for quite a long time. I think it's caught many of the companies involved in the process by surprise that European companies are complaining that they're being shut out because the contracts are being funded by U.S. taxpayers.
Leighton McCartney, are there other companies around the world that could do the same work Bechtel's going to do? And did they really seriously think they would have a shot, given that a lot of the commercial relationships in Iraq pre-war went back to France, Russia, other countries that were staunch opponents of this war? Did anyone really believe Washington would turn around and let them in to profit from the rebuilding?
No, I think realistically not. Of course, if it had been a true coalition in which you had participation by some of those countries, it would be hard to deny them, at least, you know, even the British, a lot of the British businessmen have been complaining that that Blair really didn't get much for the British in terms of the work in post-war Iraq. The other thing I think is curious, and I don't have any insight into it, but why shut down the Syrian, the Iraqi-Syrian pipeline so early, particularly when you're calling off the UN the blockade? I'm not sure where that's leading.
This is the oil pipeline from Iraq through Syria. What does it suggest to you, that someone wants to build another pipeline somewhere else?
Very possibly, yeah. I mean, that as you remember, when we cut off our relationships with Iraq, that one of the problems was that they refused to build the pipeline from Iraq to Jordan.
Mm-hmm. They were afraid of getting it near Israel would create vulnerability for it.
Well, that was one of the reasons. But they had gotten assurances from the Israelis that the security problems wouldn't be an issue. And so I think there were other reasons that compounded that, but certainly that was one of their concerns. But Bechtel was directly behind that and would have been the builder of that pipeline. So I'm throwing that out there. It seems strange to me that we should suddenly block that pipeline for whatever reason.
Josh Chaffin, could you walk us through some of the other contracts that have already been signed or are in process right now? There's an awful lot of work that's going to be done here right across the board, from the very fundamental things like power and water and sewer, right on up through putting, as I understand it, notebooks and pencils on the desks of Iraqi children and retraining Iraqi teachers. Can you give us a kind of a tour of the horizon of what contracts have been let here?
There are. There are eight of these initial contracts that USAID is overseeing. One of the first ones to be given out was the administration of the port at Umm Qasr, which is, I guess, the main and the deepest water port for Iraq. That was given to Steve Doering Services of America, which is based in Seattle. Most of these other contracts, they're mostly administrative contracts, so they're not rebuilding the port but actually running it. There's another one coming up to run the airport. As you mentioned, they're contracts for to provide textbooks and education for the school system. those are relatively small dollar amounts. The real jewel is the contract that Bechtel won today to actually go in, repair the port, repair the schools, repair the hospitals, repair the power systems, et cetera.
The heavy work right across the country.
The feeling among many people is that those contracts will really that contract could set Bechtel up for a lot of additional work, particularly possibly in the oil sector. So that's why, although the dollar amount, $680 million, by its own, is actually smaller than a lot of contracts that that the companies won in the U.S., that's the promise of future business, so the possibility is why it's being looked at as so lucrative.
There could be a long, long tail here. And Halliburton, where, as you say, Vice President Dick Cheney was CEO for a number of years until 2000. Halliburton is involved or is involved in putting out oil fires, had its eyes on much bigger contracts and I think withdrew at some point. Is Halliburton still involved or not through subsidiaries? What's the picture there, Josh?
That's right. Halliburton's Kellogg Brown and Root subsidiary won a contract from the Army Corps of Engineers, and that was to do sort of emergency repair work in the oil sector and also put out oil well fires. It's a pretty controversial contract because the top line dollar amount of it was set at $7 billion.
And that was if all the wells were on fire, I guess, in worst case
exactly.
scenario.
It's quite a big number. Mm-hmm. And Halliburton was given the contract without competition. The company had actually set up a plan some months ago to potentially fight fires, a contingency plan, I guess. And then they won the actual contract to carry that out.
And they have not withdrawn from that contract, though the problem in the event is not nearly as big as it might have been. Is that right?
No. The amount of work the company has been authorized to do so far has only been $50 million thus far. And only a handful of the wells have actually been torched. So although the number sounds quite large on that one, the actual dollar value hasn't been that great and probably will not be. But again, the question is, does that contract set them up or position them to do more lucrative work down the road.
And of course, it was potentially huge. It could have been that $7 billion, which a lot of people are looking at kind of cross-eyed, given that the vice president was the head there so recently. Leighton McCartney, I heard you there.
I'm just sorry. I just want to insert two things quickly. I think you'll see that Halliburton will be subcontracted by Bechtel to do some of that work, which I think is the tacit understanding that, and I think Parsons is set up front that if they got the contract, they were also bidding on that contract that Bechtel got, that they would subcontract some of it to Halliburton. And the other thing I think is interesting here is the water, because as you may know, Bechtel's been talking about privatizing water and got to a brouhaha in Bolivia about some
globally.
Mm-hmm. And certainly Iraq, there were problems getting early on getting water into Basra, and Iraq certainly is a good candidate for a water infrastructure.
What about this Halliburton subcontracting, Josh Chaffin? They've stepped back at a formal level to say, no, I guess they said we've got these connections, we realize it's not kosher for us to be in here, but in fact, at the subcontracting level, that they will be in there.
I think to some degree all these companies will be involved at the subcontracting level, whether or in the contracts, whether they win it outright or they're subcontractors, and so many other companies as well. USAID has estimated that up to 50% of the past contracts in places like Bosnia and Afghanistan have gone to subcontractors, and I don't think there's any doubt that that whoever wins these, Bechtel, et cetera, is going to hand off quite a lot of the work to other companies, whether they're other U.S. companies or other companies in the region or Europe. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of work to go around.
Leighton McCartney, we just got 30 seconds left before the break, and I know we have to let you go. But in the Bechtel corporate history, is this a banner day, opening up new vistas in Iraq? How big a deal is this?
Well, I think it's an important deal for them at this time because, much of the world, and particularly this country, and there are not many major infrastructure projects that are underway or even being completed now. They just finished the big dig in Bahr, and they haven't finished it, but it's up to $14 billion. So it's an important contract for them.
Leighton McCartney, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Leighton McCarthy is author of Friends in High Places, The Bechtel Story, The Most Secret Corporation, and How It Engineered the World. We're talking tonight about the money pot in rebuilding Iraq and who's getting the work. Is this War Incorporated going in for the big post-war bucks? Is this crony capitalism? Or is this just what it takes to get clean water, roads, schools, and hospitals to Iraq fast? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the money pot in rebuilding Iraq and who's getting the work. You can join the conversation. Does the U.S. risk looking like it's in the business of war here, or is this the way to mercy, to high-speed reconstruction? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined by Joshua Chathan, Washington business correspondent for the Financial Times. And we're joined now from San Francisco by Farhad Manju. He's a reporter for Salon.com and author of War, Inc. and To the Victor Go the Spoils at Salon.com. Good evening and welcome, Farhad Manju.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Farhad, you've written a lot about who's been lobbying for what and who's getting what. Describe to us, if you would, who the major players are and the kind of the network of connections that has put these companies in position to reap these big contracts in post-war Iraq.
Well, I was actually just listening to your other two guests, and I think they've sort of described it perfectly. And today I heard you were discussing about Bechtel getting the big contract today, and that's sort of one of the prime examples of a company with very close connections lining up for, rebuilding contracts.
But we've got, though, congressmen lining up now to criticize this, Maxine Waters and John Dingell and others, saying we've got all kinds of conflicts of interest underlying the contracts as they're going out. Is this just rich political fodder, or is there a real concern here that things are tilted in a way that makes a kind of circle between big contractors, Republican campaign coffers, and back through the war?
Well, it certainly looks bad. So, I mean, it does make for a certain sort of political fodder, but it's not totally unreasonable to ask about why there were, closed bidding processes. Besides the sort of the Congress people you mentioned more recently, Senator Wyden has advocated a more fully competitive bidding process because these are just sort of this is sort of at this point the start of what could be a huge rebuilding process. And I think that if it goes on this way, where there are closed bidding processes and companies with very close ties to the White House getting these contracts, then people have a lot of questions.
Farhad, can you describe to us some of the decisions being made now by the way these contracts are let around, systems, electrical systems, telecom systems? Presumably the first footprint that goes down will have a lot to do with the way Iraq is rebuilt.
Right. I mean, as we know, the contract for major infrastructure rebuilding went to Bechtel today, and that's sort of the big stuff that you talked about. All of the, it's major construction work. Smaller things in further contracts, I suppose, will depend a lot, especially the humanitarian side, will depend a lot on what happens at the UN and sort of the larger political jockeying for, who rules Iraq in the near future. At this point, though, it's most of the stuff that's going on has been, infrastructure stuff. We saw a contract go to the stevedoring company for the deep water port. So it's that kind of stuff.
But, for example, Iraq's will presumably need an awful lot of reconstruction in telecommunications. Europe and the United States go very different ways when it comes to mobile telecom. Does the U.S. reconstruction make it likely that Iraq will be pulled into the orbit of U.S. technology here?
Well, there's an interesting story about cell phones in Iraq. Recently, Daryl Issa, who's a congressman in Southern California, he said or proposed the idea that we should have an American cell phone system in Iraq, when already over there they have this sort of nascent system that uses the GSM system, which is what they use in
Europe, standard.
Europe, right, and this was seen as sort of the most blatant kind of boosterism, American boosterism, because more than Daryl Issa is sort of just being an American congressman, he represents the district in which Qualcomm is based, and Qualcomm came up with the system that that Issa says we ought to use in Iraq. So, you're going to see sort of a lot of this, I think.
Josh Chaffin, pre-war, Iraq was not and has not ever been really a big part of the American technology and commercial circuit. Wasn't it much more dominated by French companies, more recently Russian companies, European companies? This hasn't exactly been friendly turf for U.S. companies for a long time, has it?
That's right. I think they've had the French and Russian companies in particular have had much longer and deeper commercial relationships there. And I think there's a feeling among a lot of people in the U.S. administration and the business community here that during the Oil for Food program, if they U.S. companies submitted requests or bids, that they more often than not expected that the winner would ultimately be French or Russian. So the feeling now is that U.S. companies have been at the back of the line, and there's a lot of excitement among lobbyists, business lobbyists here in particular, that they're now moving to the front of the line.
Well, they're all at the front of the line, and there is no back of the line anymore, is there? I mean, is there any work being set aside for anyone but U.S. firms, and is that important? How does that matter, Josh Chaffin?
Well, first of all, it's too early to say. I think these initial contracts are actually just they're a small piece. As we've already said, they do potentially have a lot of value if they add to follow-on work. But the supposition of all the future and additional work, and I think it's the number thrown around commonly is $100 billion, $20 billion a year over 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's yet to be determined who is actually going to pay that and who's going to control the process, whether it'll be the U.S. or how much of the money will come from the United Nations, how much of it within the U.S., which part of the government will it actually come from or who will actually administer it.
And will it come from Iraqi oil profits?
Exactly. All of those are kind of up in the air in the moment. And I think for lobbyists, it's actually it's meant a lot of activity because they've sort of had to go to appeal to everybody in town. Nobody's sure exactly who's controlling the process. So you've sort of had a situation where they have to cover their bases everywhere.
Activity sounds like a mild word for it. Joshua Farhad, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join the conversation. Dan's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually wanted to ask about the details of the contracts. I think I read on the BBC that the contracts are written up so that the U.S. government will reimburse the companies for each dollar they spend in fulfilling the contract and will then, in addition to that, guarantee a profit of 1%.
So it's a cost-plus kind of contract, as you understand it.
Right, and the terms of the contract, if they're such as I just described, seem quite patently to be vulnerable to abuse. So I wanted to hear some commentary on that.
Great. Dan, thanks for your call, and let's see what we know. Of course, Bechtel has been very prominent in Boston recently with a huge infrastructure project laying down new highway underground. It's gone way, way over budget. Farhad Manju, what do you know about the format of these contracts?
I think the caller's right about the cost plus thing, and he asked about possibilities for abuse. I mean, no one's sort of accusing these companies of abuse, but this is sort of known to happen I think it was in Afghanistan, but I'm not positive.
I think didn't Brown and Root have a big overrun in Bosnia?
In Bosnia, that's what it was. They were sort of investigated for overcharging or not paying that much attention to the cost, which I suppose it doesn't work in our interest as taxpayers.
I think there were some cases, Tom, actually in Bosnia where they were using or billing the government as much as, I think, $80 for plywood boards that actually retailed for about $15. And there were other cases cited in a General Accounting Office report that offices were being cleaned 4 and 5 times a day and that sort of thing. So it is, I think if it's a government contract and it's cost plus, and I think the percentage may actually be more than 1%. I know on the oil well fire, it's 6 or 7%.
And if it's a wild and woolly environment like Iraq, I mean, that leaves an enormous amount of room for firms that have run way over, even in relatively constricted environments like downtown Boston.
Well, there's also a lot of concern. It's not only the what will the master contractor, Halliburton or Bechtel, do, but all of the layers of subcontractors beneath them that are working at a local level, where business controls may not even exist. So all of these costs presumably would be passed on.
Josh Chaffin, Farhad Manju, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Fort Lee, New Jersey, Larry Korb. He's Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and held an important post in the Reagan administration. Good evening and welcome, Larry Korb.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Larry Korb, you've seen the flurry of attention to these contracts. Today, of course, the big Bechtel contract is the news, as much as $680 million. And perhaps, of course, with the long tail, these things have much more to come. There is a chorus in Congress now saying this is crony capitalism. These are favors being handed out to companies close to the Bush administration. On the other hand, our guests tonight are saying there is only a handful of companies in the world capable of doing some of these jobs. What's your view of what's unfolding here on the rebuilding front with Iraq?
Well, basically, in the short term, the government's under a lot of pressure to do something, as we've seen. With the end of the war coming so quickly, there's a lot of things that have to, services that have to be restored. In an emergency like that, the government turns to companies it's used to doing business with. There's only a handful of companies, really, that would fall into that category. A lot of them, like Bechtel and, you know, Halliburton and Brown and Root, have done a lot of business for the Pentagon. Some of them are doing stuff over in Kosovo, for example. And so under this emergency thing, one would want to move quickly. After the initial phase is over, I think you could go back to the normal procedure, but this is not, you know, not normal.
But won't these firms be greatly advantaged by being in first? And does it give you a strange feeling to see Halliburton coming back in very likely as a subcontractor here when the vice president of the United States was heading up that company just a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I know. There's no doubt about that fact. I mean, you know, when Dick Cheney was, you know, running that company, he wanted to lift sanctions against Iraq. So, I mean, he was, you know, pushing for a different point of view.
And then, of course, was a primary architect, ultimately, of the war against Iraq.
That's right. And, you know, I know when I worked in government, because my boss, Cap Weinberger, had been with Bechtel, there was this concern. We know that George Shultz is still on the board there. He's been a big supporter. But I think if you took a look at all of those companies, the fact of the matter is that all of them have been big contributors to the Republican parties, and it certainly does create, you know, a real, you know, a perception problem. But on the other hand, the people who are running this thing, the career people, are under the gun to get something going, and they normally turn to people that they've been accustomed to, you know, doing business with. So this was inevitable given the whole way in which this situation played out.
So everyone wants to see, as soon as possible, smiling Iraqis. I mean, that's been put forward as the standard by which this is going to be judged, not the kind of anarchy and in some areas misery we've seen in the first days after the war. But Larry Korb, doesn't it seem somehow just a little too convenient that means very big contracts with potentially very long lives for firms so close to the ruling party here?
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you're in this situation, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because if you don't get stuff going, you know, for example, Brown and Root, which is, you know, part of Halliburton. I mean, Brown and Root was in Haiti under Clinton. Mm-hmm. And did an awful lot of work. In fact, I know my own son-in-law got hired by them. He was a former Marine, was sent down there. Well, that happened under Clinton, so they have experience in this. And, you know,
right.
Cheney was brought into that company primarily because of his background in this area. But on the other hand, they're a good company. They do good, solid work, and that's really what you're trying to get accomplished. My hope is that once the initial phase is over and we realize how long we're going to be there, we can get back to kind of the normal way of doing things.
But for right now, who wouldn't want to see hospitals and clean water in Iraq? Louise is calling from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Louise. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
I just am calling because with the perspective of how other countries will view the United States using contractors from our country,
yeah.
My sense of that is we invested a lot of money and time and our own children to help Iraqi individuals have freedom. And I think for us to try to reinvest now and get some of that money back, you know, is realistic. I don't think it's – and I guess we didn't care what they thought when we went to war to free Iraq either. Why should that be an issue now when we're trying to bring them back to a,
right,
you know, standard of living.
So at this point, Louise, it looks like the turnabout's fair play here, kind of to the victor go the spoils, and that's fine by you.
Well, we're not the victor. The Iraqis are. And what I'm saying is we invested money up front mm-hmm. to help them get that freedom. And why shouldn't we get some of that money back by helping them to, you know, restructure their country?
We've got it, and that's a line of logic that I'm sure is a popular one. Larry Korb, you can see the kind of quid pro quo idea there. Does that line up with standard international practice, with international ethics?
Well, Louise is raising a different question. Had this war been fought under UN authorization, had we had more a real coalition rather than us and the British and, you know, a few other countries who are not, you know, major powers, obviously it would have been different. But the administration has made a decision that that wouldn't be the case.
Those countries made a decision as well not to participate.
And you know, we're still the debate about, you know, when does the UN get involved and how does it get involved. So in the interim, the people in the U.S. government who really don't make those decisions, those are made above their level, they've got a job, and so they got to get things going very, 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 you know, quickly. I would hope that eventually we could internationalize this rebuilding, because, you know, it's one thing to win a war, it's much more difficult to win the peace, and if we're held completely responsible for anything that goes wrong, it could tarnish our reputation down the road and undermine the great good we've done by getting rid of Saddam Hussein.
Farhad Manjoo, what's your perspective on whether or not this is likely to ultimately open up to firms from other countries? Does the administration seem sensitive to that? Is that important to them, or are they taking the attitude, like our caller Louise, look, we fought this war, we won this liberation for Iraq, and our company should benefit from the reconstruction?
Well, in the interviews I've heard and sort of been a party to, I think that they've sort of taken the line that the caller did, that we fought this war, we sort of invested in it, and there's nothing wrong with American firms getting the money from this. The response to that, though, is that, you know, it looks bad, and it looks bad to the Iraqis, the people who were saving. It looks bad because it looks like the United States went in there in order to – I mean, I've been asked by lots of people whether we went in there to bomb places so that the people who are close to the vice president can rebuild those
sort
places.
Of tear the country up and turn it into a profit center.
Right, exactly. I mean, it just sort of has this appearance of impropriety, and it might ultimately hurt the rebuilding cause and the way the Iraqis feel toward the United States if we're seen as, you know, profiting from something as, you know, horrible as war. More than that, it's not only, I mean, we should remember that the British were our best ally in this war, and they're not happy about this either. So
no slice of pie for the British at this point. Farhad Manjoo, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Mm-hmm.
Farhad Manjoo joined us from San Francisco. He's a reporter for Salon.com. We're talking tonight about the money pot in rebuilding Iraq and who's getting the work. Is this War Incorporated going in for the big post-war bucks, or is this just what it takes to get clean water, roads, schools, and hospitals to Iraq fast? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the money pot in rebuilding Iraq and who's getting the work. You can join the conversation. Does the United States risk looking like it's in the business of war, or is this the quickest way to mercy, to high-speed reconstruction? And can you imagine the campaign contributions these contracts will produce? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Larry Korb, joining us from Fort Lee, New Jersey, Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former Reagan administration official. And from Washington, Josh Chaffin, Washington business correspondent for the Financial Times. You're welcome to join us as well. Imad is calling from Southborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Imad. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, I think the whole issue of this war has been controversial all over the world. And I am one of the people who came to this country having great expectations. I held the United States as a center of democracy, justice, values.
So what does the rebuilding program look like to you, Ahmad?
The rebuilding program puts a lot of question marks on the whole motive behind the work.
Why? What are you suggesting?
In essence, you know, if we fought this war to liberate the Iraqis, then we should give the Iraqis some kind of decision-making process to help decide who built their country. Now, if we fought this war to protect ourselves from, or it's like a preemptive kind of war, then we are practically occupying the country, and we have no right to decide who built the country for
us. But, Ahmad, what about the caller Louise's point from Wisconsin saying the United States went in to liberate Iraq? Why should these contracts now go to French or Russian or German firms?
See, the way she looks at it is, this is a like a venture. We went and ventured, and so we should be rewarded. I don't think when it comes to values and when it comes to helping each other, we should be expecting reward for that. And if we look at it that way, I think we are a little bit autistic. We don't see how the world sees us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the world certainly does not see it that way. You know, if I am a doctor at a hospital and I'm referring all these patients to have blood work done at the same hospital, there is some kind of conflict of interest.
Ahmad, we've got the point, and thanks for calling in with it. Josh Chaffin, what do you think?
I think he's right. Well, excuse me, sorry. I think the previous caller had used the word save in terms of we're saving Iraqis, mm-hmm. and I think it's dangerous to take for granted that the rest of the world views it that way. Again, I think this is it's really a case of image and optics. These companies may be the best ones for the job. It may be most convenient. It may adhere to U.S. procurement laws. But at the same time, it sets up a lot of issues. It raises a lot of suspicions and doubts among people around the world who already have doubts about the U.S.'s motives. And I think to the extent that the U.S. tries to punish companies from other countries, it's actually just going to kind of fuel those doubts. So I think it's not the best road for the U.S. to follow. And I think it'll be important to look at the additional contracts, not just this first batch, mm-hmm. but the next ones down the road. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones where I think we'll see exactly how much work is going to go to other people.
Larry Korb, what's your view? You know this chasm is out there of perception about what's going on in Iraq. The United States, people tend to look at it as certainly the White House and the major media description of it is, here's a liberation. Much of the rest of the world has a kind of different view. Does the reconstruction have much to do with how that perception ultimately plays out?
Well, I think it does. And I mean, unfortunately, where you have the situation now, first of all, if the U.S. government was going to be in control, certainly it should be the State Department. Colin Powell wrote to Rumsfeld saying, you know, we would like to do that. A lot of the international aid organizations don't want to work through the Pentagon, but the Pentagon is in charge of it. And you have the office set up under a retired, three-star general who is going to be running it. The longer that goes on, I agree, the more problems you're going to have. What you need to do as quickly as you can is, after you take care of the immediate needs, is get this under the supervision of a international organization like the United Nations. Because even if you might make a little bit of money, or these companies will make a little bit of money and have an impact on the American economy in the short term, if the United States has to pay the whole bill for reconstructing it or leave a couple of 100,000 troops there, we're going to lose money in the long run, as well as be blamed for anything that happens.
That brings up a couple of interesting things, Larry Korb. One is, how do you think this is going to end up being paid for? There's still this speculation out there that somehow the U.S. will tap Iraqi oil revenues and say, well, we're building Iraq, so of course Iraqi revenues should pay for this. And secondly, how big a portion of this work is going to, how much of this money is going to be going simply to housing and feeding and caring for U.S. troops stationed long-term in Iraq?
Well, keeping the troops there is about a $1 billion a week with this number that you have there, and obviously that goes for that.
But we're talking about barracks being built, so that's not just camping out in Humvees anymore.
No,
that's settling in for the long haul.
That's right. I mean, if you're going to be there for the long haul, the question is how many troops. Remember, the Army mm-hmm. Chief of Staff, General Shinseki, said about 200 to keep the situation under control.
200,000.
Yeah, 200,000. I'm sorry. Yeah, 200,000. And the administration's, some of the political people said no. The question really becomes how much cooperation are you going to get from other countries to send troops in there. So whatever the number is, it's not all U.S., and that will hold down the cost. As far as bringing the oil back on, it's going to take a while to get that up to where you need to be. I mean, even though they didn't destroy many of the oil wells, they have not invested very much in there. It's going to be very hard to get that above the level that they've been using under the U.N. Food for Oil program.
But when President Bush goes to the U.N. saying, lift the sanction on Iraq, lift the sanctions, Larry Korb, is that seen as President Bush trying to get that oil money flowing in a way that it can pay U.S. corporations for rebuilding Iraq?
Well, I think in the interim, he's got to get that out just to get food for the Iraqis, let alone rebuilding it, I mean, because that's what it was going for. And basically, right now, Iraq can't export any oil until the U.N., votes on it. And then you get into a whole other issue. What is the role of the U.N., and are the countries on the Security Council going to be exact, if you will, revenge on us for, you know, the way in which we disregarded it? So this contract thing is, I think, a part of a whole big mosaic that you need to work out. And while in the short run it may help these companies, in the long run, if the United States continues on the same path, it's going to cost all of us a lot more money.
Josh Chaffin, 1947, with the implementation of the Marshall Plan, Winston Churchill ultimately described that as the most unsordid act in history. And, of course, most of that money went to Europe, and Europeans did a lot of their own reconstruction. Are we on a path? Will this get on a path that may be assessed in that way as one of the most unsordid acts in history, ultimately?
Well, I think it's still far too early to tell. But I think we should look at how much of these initial contracts are actually given out to subcontractors and how much of that is given to local subcontractors. I know in Afghanistan, U.S. companies in charge of building the highway there and actually has given a lot of the work to local Afghans. So I think we have to look a little bit beyond the sort of initial headlines of Bechtel, Halliburton, whoever mm-hmm. else cashing in, and see where the dollars actually end up. It's possible that quite a lot of the work could actually go to even French and German and Russian companies that nobody thought would win out in the end. And hopefully, certainly, a lot of it will go to
Iraqis.
Companies in the immediate region, exactly. But
Larry,
I think we'll have to wait and see.
And Larry Korb, we've just got 20 seconds left, but do you see a 2004 campaign season issue here, crony capitalism around Iraq?
No, I really don't.
Mm-hmm. Just don't see it there. Don't think it has legs for the Democrats.
No, I don't think so, because you'll find out that a lot of these companies did business during the Clinton administration as well.
So it crosses right across those lines. Big companies, a lot of power, a lot of connections. Larry Korb, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Larry Korb is Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. And Josh Chaffin, joining us from Washington, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joshua Chaffin is Washington business correspondent for the Financial Times. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the new sensation on eBay, memorabilia from the war in Iraq. This is On Point.
This pack of cards, the 55 thugs that are out there, how can we get our hands on them?
I'm told they're on eBay.
Donald Rumsfeld, major corporations are not the only ones profiting from the war in Iraq. With remarkable speed, soldiers in Iraq, their families, and ambitious entrepreneurs at home have turned to make a fast buck on Iraq war memorabilia by selling memorabilia on eBay. There online, you can find everything from those 55 most wanted playing cards to authentic Iraqi dinars to wartime T-shirts and bumper stickers. Scott Wilson is an antiques dealer who spends a good part of his day selling merchandise on eBay. We caught up with him at his home computer in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, to surf eBay and see what was for sale.
I would probably just type in Iraq to begin with, and so there we got 7,621 items for Iraq. Here's a 2000 Freedom Iraq action figure set that's going for $315. So they've already produced action figures having to do with Iraqi freedom. Oh my God. Well, it looks like we're looking at little plastic G.I. Joe type figures named Alden, Alex, Brad, all American guys, Jennifer, Josh, Simon, Leon. This is hysterical. So yeah, they've already come out with collectible action figures for Iraqi freedom. The most wanted card set, I've heard, is pretty popular on eBay at the current moment, so we're going to give a quick search and see what we can come up with. There we go. We've got 82 of them. The highest deck right now is up to $61. My guess is in about a month's time, you're not going to be able to get $5 for these things. My feeling is that most of these card sets, you know, probably 99% of them are probably legit. You know, some supply sergeant over in Iraq has probably shipped home cases of these things to his loved ones to make a few extra bucks. You know, the thing that I'd be very wary of now collecting, you know, Iraqi stuff, I see 8x10 glossies of autographed pictures of Saddam Hussein. And my guess is that Saddam wasn't handing out a lot of 8x10 glossies of himself and signing them. So those I would be very leery about buying anything like that. The decks of cards seem to me that they would be a fairly easy thing to get hold of. Probably there's soldiers all over the place sending these home with the idea, like, get these things back into the hands of my brother and make a few bucks. You know, I noticed, too, that people are breaking down the sets and selling the cards individually. So you can pick up a Baghdad Bob, you know, the Minister of Information. You can pick him up for $9 separately. Let's try Baghdad Bob and see what comes up for that guy. Because he was very popular, and I'll bet anything there's probably stuff already having to do with him on here. And sure enough, there's a Baghdad Bob Saddam mug set. So somebody has already produced. Oh, look at that. Baghdad Bob with a Apache helicopter attacking him from behind, and then Baghdad Bob in front of the toppling statue of Saddam. And the caption says, Saddam was going to tear that down anyway. And it goes on to say that the set is 100% dishwasher safe. Unbelievable. We've come across Middle East Iraq sand. Well, let's see what it says. You are bidding on 4 ounces of Iraqi sand. It is sealed in an attractive rum glass bottle with the label removed, filled to the rim. You too can own a small hunk of Iraq. No picture of the most coveted rum bottle full of Iraqi sand. Now this reminds me of Elian Gonzalez, you know, when people were selling parts of his raft on eBay. So you have to be very, very careful when this stuff happens. I mean, anybody could fill a glass with a bunch of sand and say that it came from Iraq.
Scott Wilson is an antiques dealer and an eBay regular. We surfed with him at his home in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.